the last few windows that have never been seen before. So the people doing the nibbling are people on Hess and Veritas, and Ken Reagan from McGill is one of those people who will tell us about what the exciting things are that are being found in the new TV camera sky.
Okay, so thanks very much. It's my first visit to PI. I'm very happy to be here. Thank you for the invitation. It's a little bit different than what you should have spent most of your days thinking about. So, you know, I'll walk you through it. Hopefully, you'll see there's some rest and signs and do that. So I'm going to talk about the TeV energy scale in photons. Still being pulled up.
That was a lunch, right?
Okay. And we'll see some of these ideas. So first of all, I'd like to set the scale by just sort of walking you through how we learn about the cosmos. You can know this obviously, but I just want to remind you of a few issues when I'm supposed to turn this on. I'll turn it off and then run any politically incorrect jokes. But that doesn't happen very often. I was in Hamilton, and I had to make a joke, of course, about the Hamilton hockey team, because there isn't one here. I can't even do that. So then I'll talk specifically about the science of high-energy astrophysics, things, what we'd like to learn, what some of the interesting objects and questions are. And then I'm going to go on to a more prosaic, pragmatic plane to talk specifically about how one detects gamma rays and neutral beams, and then talk to you about some results from a new array of telescopes called KESS, which in the interest of full disclosure, I will tell you, it's not my experiment. So I'm presenting somebody else's results. And it's disappointing to say it's not our experiment, but we have an experiment called Veritas, which is similar to HESS, but unfortunately it's a European experiment. This is largely US-funded, and the US funding situation being what it is, this thing is now taking a couple of years of delay with respect to HESS. So it's coming on stream shortly, and I'll tell you very, very briefly about Veritas and GLASS, which hopefully over the next 2 or 3 years, we'll have multiple telescope arrays, multiple detectors that will help to focus in on this area. Okay, so we learn about the universe obviously through a very limited number of things: photons, cosmic rays, neutrinos, gravity waves, perhaps. We don't know. These three things, of course, have all been seen, although neutrinos have never been seen convincingly from outside of our own, basically outside of our own galaxy. And even then, there's only a single source outside of our own solar system, but we certainly have learned about the world by them. Cosmic rays have been known for about 100 years, and I'll talk a little bit about the cosmic rays. And fundamentally, of course, most of our interesting information comes from photons. I use the word messenger here because Galileo first published his revolutionary results in something called the Starry Messenger in 1610, and probably you know, at that point, his funding should have been cut off, having done all the revolutionary discoveries with the first instrument that he built. Presumably, at that point, declining returns cut in. But nonetheless, we've done 4 centuries of astronomy since then, and we've learned a lot about the universe. Who knows what's coming down the pipe? But certainly, in the next several years, we'd like to see gravity waves being detected, and there's some hope that that will actually occur. You will hear about this in particular from Francis Halsing in a couple of weeks, and I'll at least give you a lead as to why that is interesting from my perspective, instead of some of the objects that I study in photons. So here's the cosmic ray spectrum. I'm going to talk about cosmic rays just for a little bit, but that's not what this talk is about, so it's just to set the stage, and then we'll come back and talk about photons. This is the cosmic ray diffuse spectrum over something like several tens of orders of magnitude, and something like 30 orders of magnitude in flux. So truly amazing that you can measure something that is over those sorts of dynamic ranges, what we can. And it turns out to be a relatively featureless spectrum in terms of energy. So energy, the cosmic right here in flux. It's basically a power law spectrum. It's got two distinguishing features that are called the knee and the ankle, after obvious the obvious parallel being with the leg here. It turns out then that there's a change of slope in here, and there's another change of slope there. And you can see the fluxes that you have to deal with if you want to measure these things: a particle per square meter per year here, and a particle per square kilometer here. And by the time you're out at 10 to 20 eV, the highest energies, you're talking about a few particles per square kilometer per century. So you can see why cosmic ray detectors are generally relatively large, and the newest ones are several thousands of square kilometers. Distributed areas, of course, not close path to those areas. in order to have detectable event rates. And there's some belief that this is galactic and this is extragalactic, but in fact, we don't really know much about that. The interesting part of that spectrum, from my perspective, would be the highest energy events above 10 to 20 eV. And they're somewhat mysterious, largely because the acceleration processes are unknown. But even if you were able to accelerate those charged cosmic rays up to those energies, then you should scatter off CMB photons, and that should lead to an absorption. You scatter in processes like this, where you produce physical particles, and you effectively degrade the cosmic ray energy. And the universe then becomes opaque at sort of a megaparsec scale, which is not very large. It's just outside of our own local group. So effectively, you don't see far out into the universe. And you would expect then to see something like this line, this solid line, to give you the GZK limit that cuts off 10 to 20 eV or so. And in fact, it's clear that there are events out beyond the GZK limit out here. There's only a handful of them now. I think there's 17 or 19 in this particular plot. And this is one of the reasons that things like the Auger cosmic ray detector have been built to really get much better statistics here and map out whether or not we just simply missed the cutoff through something we don't understand, and maybe this whole line should just be shifted by a half a decade to the right, or if there's a problem here, or if indeed we're seeing super GZK events, and we don't know much about those things. Cosmic rays, of course, are charged particles. They're subject to magnetic fields. Galaxies are known to have harbor magnetic fields. There are also intergalactic fields, and those are important for this because if you take a typical micro-Gauss magnetic field in a galaxy, then the Larmor radius of something that's at 10 to 20 eV is of the order of the size of the galaxy, kiloparsecs or so. Which means that even if you could get these things beyond GZK energy, then you can't really do astronomy with them because they're curving, of course, and they don't point back to their sources. So there's this triple whammy in very high energy cosmic rays. These are the most energetic things we know, but they don't point back to where you're going. We don't understand why they're not absorbed by the GZK, and we don't even understand how to get rid of those energies. So to really do astronomy and point back to these neutral particles, and that's why we focus then on the high energy gamma regime. So this is now, that's all I'm going to say about cosmic rays, at least the cosmic ray spectrum. Turning now to the photon spectrum, here's an equivalent plot to the cosmic ray spectrum. This is now the wavelength of the energy, whichever way you choose to look at it, and here's the flux. And again, several decades here and several decades there. These open points up here are the cosmic ray spectrum that I just showed you, and you can see that it's several orders of magnitude above the upper limits of this energy for the diffuse photon flux. So we actually haven't measured diffuse photons at this energy. We have measured diffuse photons at these lower energies, so we're going to be working right in here in the GEV TEV energy regime. And it turns out, of course, as Cliff said, that we've seen revolutionary things at every single wavelength that we've ever looked at. And so, of course, we're hoping the clear corollary is that we're hoping that we also learn something dramatically new at these wavelengths that we haven't looked at precisely before, looked at in a very sensitive way, but we'll see it. So at the radio, for instance, we discovered radio galaxies, we discovered pulsars. If we look at the time of arrival of radio waves, we look at the time sliced away. This thing here is the CMB bump, the black body through the CMB. And of course, we learned a lot about cosmology, among other things, from the CMB. This is optical, where we've learned a tremendous amount, including, for instance, the fact that we live in an expanding, accelerating universe. And these are X-ray regimes. There's a diffuse X-ray flux, but we've learned about point sources as well, such as X-ray binaries and black holes. We'll come back to this a little bit later. And of course, we don't know what's here, and that's one of the reasons we want to look at. So if we look at what's known, then in the GEV, TEV energy regime, a lot of that information comes from an instrument called EGRIT, which was flown on board the Compton Gamma Ray Observatory about 10 years ago or so, and I'll talk a little bit more about EGRIT. This is EGRIT's all-sky map in galactic coordinates. This is the plane of the galaxy, north and south galactic poles, for all photons that they detected above 100 MeV, so 0.1 GEV. We're not talking about many GEV here or even TEV, even just GEV gamma rays. There's a bright emission in the plane of the galaxy, which is understood to be due to charged cosmic rays interacting in the material in the plane of the galaxy and emitting these gamma rays. But you can see that there's a number of point sources here, and I'll show that a little bit more clearly in the next transparency. Those point sources include things like active galactic nuclei, supernova remnants, radio galaxies in this case, course here. This is the crowd, the famous crowd pulse already in there. And we hope at some point in the future that we will actually have gammas from GRBs, gamma ray bursts. Ingrid didn't see any of those, but so gamma ray bursts are typically lower energies. So the universe then is a busy place of these sorts of energies, sub GeV energies. Here's the again the data from the EGRIT detector, and now what we've done is take out all the diffuse photon flux and come down to the point source catalog here, and there's several hundred point sources on EGRIT's point source catalog, and they fall into three major classes. There's a class that is unidentified, which means that there is no convincing unique explanation of this source in terms of a known object, an AGN or an SNR or something else. And then there are things that are clearly tied to two known source types of sources, supernova remnants, SNRs, and active galactic nuclei, AGNs. And so I'll talk a little bit about each of these in turn, not the unidentified, each of these in turn, and look at a little bit of the physics that's known and unknown. Both of these things involve very different power sources. If you want to talk about these energies, then you have to try to understand how things are accelerated to these energies. There are two very different types of acceleration, and power sources, not acceleration specifically, but power sources, electromagnetic and gravitational. This is clearly, electromagnetic clearly comes into play, in particular in the case of pulsars, which we now understand, of course, to be highly rotating neutron stars, very highly magnetized objects. In terms of gravitational power, we can accrete material onto a compact disk, as that is believed to happen, at least in active galactic nuclei, and also in microquasars within our own galaxy. And of course, ultimately, you're deriving your power, gravitational power, when you're talking about core collapse of mass of stars as well, and that's what gives rise to supernova remnants. The details of all of these processes are very, very sketchy, and so that's one of the things that we'd like to understand in detail by making more detailed measurements, and not only measurements at one wave band, but across wave bands at different energies as well, to actually build detailed models for individual objects that are in each of these classes. And I'll show you sort of cartoon-type models in the next couple of questions. So a supernova remnant, of course, is a remnant of the collapse of a massive star. Typically what happens is the other layers are ejected. That shell expands into the interstellar material, and there's particle acceleration in that shock front as that happens, and then eventually the blast wave starts to decelerate. From our point of view, these supernova remnants are believed to be the source of charged cosmic rays. Now, if you actually open a standard astrophysics textbook, you will almost certainly see that phrase somewhere right up at the top of the discussion about cosmic rays, is that cosmic rays are accelerated in supernova remnants. In reality, we don't know that that's the case. That statement is often based on a simple calculation which looks at the total mechanical power that is available in supernova remnants in the galaxy, mechanical power in shock, and equates it to the total power available and observed in cosmic rays, knowing the cosmic ray flux. And it turns out that those two things are, to within about an order of magnitude or so, the same. And so a lot of astrophysicists say, terrific. Been there, done that, problem solved, let's move on. Hopefully no astrophysicists from the talk. But that's really the extent of that statement, that these things are known to be the origin of cosmic rays. We really don't know in any detail that that's the case. We've certainly never seen cosmic rays point back to an SNR. We don't have any detailed knowledge of the acceleration mechanisms. We haven't been able to build a single convincing model that shows us that that's the case. So we'd certainly like to understand that. And of course, one way is to make more observations and try to learn more things. Lee.
Is there any model which predicts the powerball of cosmic rays?
Actually, if you look into Fermi acceleration, then the claim is that Fermi acceleration gives you a very natural E-2 spectrum. Okay. So that's I'm going further than that. But that the claim is that that's a very natural approach of the Fermi model of the Fermi. It's the actual cosmic ray power from something like -2.7 or something. So it's it's sort of, it's okay to want a significant digit, right? It's maybe not even plus or minus 50%. But certainly no, I don't know the model that gets you 2.70, bang on. That's right. And it's observed to be a 2.7.
How much does it change as you go through the meets?
I just remember just off the top of my head, actually, but less than a half. I guess about 0.3 or so. I don't know, just off the top of my head. I'm going to have to go back to those. So the archetypical supernova remnant is, of course, the Crab Nebula, and Crab Nebula has been observed basically at every wavelength that people have ever looked at. So this is what the Crab Nebula looks like in the optical. If you look peer in deep inside with an X-ray detector like the Chandra X-ray detector, which is, of course, one of NASA's great observatories, then you see a region that is a strong X-ray emitter that's clearly got some interesting morphology, and it certainly looks like it's composed of some central object and material that is circularly symmetric around that object. And of course, you know, here's what the engineering drawing of it looks like. It's a rotating neutron star with an offset magnetic axis from the spin axis. The magnetic axis spins around as it presumably is a strong radio emitter. As it passes our line of sight, we see these pulses, very similar to a lighthouse. This is known to be, through its position in the sky, it's known to be the result of a supernova explosion in 1054 AD. It was observed for several months. After that that explosion, the light was observed here in 1054 AD, and it was observed for several months. And in fact, people have gone back and built a light curve based on those observations, and now believe that it was probably a type 2 supernova, and we now know, of course, that it had harbors this thing inside. The Crab Nebula is important for us as gamma ray observers because it is a standard candle for our gamma detectors. It's known to be a constantly emitting source. It's not episodic. It doesn't flare. Across now something like 20 years or 30 years, it is known to be constant at all wavelengths. It's the nebula itself. I'm not talking about pulsar. And it's somewhat of a success for people building models here because the spectrum has been measured over several decades in energy, and it's got a sort of a typical, now it's known as a typical double hump structure in which it's got a peak here down in the sort of NEV energy regime, and these are all satellite-borne detectors here, and then it's got a second peak up here in the GEV to TEV regime here. And it's known actually that this is a synchrotron radiation down here because its polarization is measured, so it's certainly strongly believed that it's a synchrotron emission spectrum, and it's believed that in this model, that the model is one in which that synchrotron population, or the population that produces those synchrotron photons, the photons are then upscattered by that same population into this peak here. So this peak is sort of the echo of this peak, and it allows people to build models based on a single parameter that relates the energy and the magnetic energy to the electric field strength from those inside that nebula. So the nebula is clearly powered by the pulsar, although that is not understood in any detail. And then these gammas are believed to arrive from this inverse complex scattering process off the synchrotron photons. Okay, the pulsar itself. So when I talk about the Crab, I mean the Crab Nebula. The pulsar itself turns out also to be a gamma ray source at energies that are GeV energies. And so here's the Crab pulsar on the left. In different wave bands, this is the optical, the X-ray, the gamma ray. Sorry, here's radio up here. Optical is green, X-ray is red, gamma ray is yellow. And you can see that although we sort of sometimes take the Crab to be archetypical, it's actually somewhat special because it's such a nice situation where it's known to pulse in all these bands. And notice that the pulse, of course, the pulse period is the same, but also the phase of the pulses are the same. So it's double phased here. And notice that those phases carry on through here. It's clearly double phased here as well. And so it's rather a unique situation. There are a number of known other pulsars that have been detected at EGOD energies, which is down here. So these are GeV energies now. And when folded at the known pulse period of the pulsar, you can see that these distributions are not flat, which means it's also pulsed. But notice that the phase relationship is not nearly so nice as in the Crab. So, for instance, here's one that is radio quiet, optically quiet, pulsed in the X-rays and pulsed in the gammas. Here's one that is radio loud but optically quiet and X-ray quiet. And so there's sort of almost all possibilities here, not quite. But you can see that these pulsars themselves, even though this may be embedded in a nebula that is an interesting object, the pulsar itself can be an interesting object. And one can build models, and depending on the models, you can predict that this GEV pulsing will cut off either at the sort of few GeV range, around the 10 GeV range, all the way up to sort of 50 to 100 GeV. Presumably, by observing that cutoff, you learn something in detail about the pulsing mechanism and about the pulsar itself. Turning now to AGNs, active galactic nuclei, these are very luminous galaxies that have a bright central core. They're believed to be powered by accretion onto galactic mass black holes, 10 to 109 solar masses, and surrounded, of course, by an accretion disk that material swirls down into the black hole. It heats, and they tend to be strong emitters, tend to be bright. So fundamentally, you're powering this thing with accretion energy, and it turns out that these objects have jets of material that is being physically emitted from the AGN, and it's got relativistic outflow velocities. So here's what one looks like in radio. So this is a radio image here. You can barely see the scales, but this is, if you then zoom in on the central core here, this is the bright central core of that spot there. This is what it looks like optically. You're not seeing down to the accretion disk, of course, as you might imagine. And then when we observe these from the Earth, if the diagram looks like this, with a black hole and an accretion disk at the center and a torus here and the emitting material and the jets here, then depending on what angle we view it from, we see different objects. So if you view it out here, for instance, you obscure all of what's occurring in here and you see the radio jets. If you happen to view it down a pipe of this jet, you see this material that's being ejected and Doppler shifted towards you, boosted towards you, and so that turns out to be the way we observe these AGNs and gammas, and we call those blazars. That's the name of the class of object. So you can build sort of cartoonish models for what happens here. Here's a black hole, here's some accretion disk, here's the material that's being emitted, and we're observing it from down here. And this stuff is somehow in here, the acceleration is occurring, and ultimately you're producing the high energy photons that are moving towards us. Of course, we don't know a lot about a lot of the details of such a cartoonish model. For instance, we don't really know how these jets form in any detail, and what powers the jet in detail. We don't know the nature of this beam, and I'll talk a little bit more about that, and that's what you'll hear about also from Francis Housing in a couple of weeks. So, for instance, we don't know the energetics of these beams. We don't even know the particle type. Are we accelerating? Are we dealing with hadronic acceleration, protons, or electron populations, for instance? We don't know the field strengths. We don't know any of the geometries out here of these emission zones and the sources, presumably, of the soft photons. So there's a tremendous amount that we don't know, and that's one of the reasons that we'd like to study these things. Here's another cartoon. This one actually comes from Francis Allison, and so my guess is you'll see this in a couple of weeks as well. This is simply meant to illustrate a single point, which is that there's, well, two points, actually. There's a lot of particle physics in here, and so understanding this probably brings in a lot of extreme particle physics. But also the second, and I think critical point that Francis will try to make, and I will make here as well, is that we really don't even know whether the original population that you're accelerating here is electronic or is hadronic. So here's an electron, there's a proton, the electron could upscatter photons and give you TeV photons. The proton could be accelerated and then through interactions give you pi zeros, which also will give you GeV photons. Notice that in this case, there's no hadronic component. In this case, there is a hadronic component. In every place you produce a pi zero, there's a chance to produce a pi minus or a pi plus, and those things decay to neutrinos. And so if the world is, or the AGNs have this sort of processes occurring inside them, then one of the things you would legitimately look for and hope to find is neutrino sources, that is, AGNs that are seeming to emit neutrinos. And that's exactly, of course, what Francis Alzheim is working on in things like Amanda and IceCube and Anita. So he will tell you way more about all of that and how to go about that. But certainly, if they were to observe sources, point sources of neutrinos, and they were positionally coincident with AGNs, then that would have taught us already a lot about what happens in here. Okay, the emission mechanism, yes.
How often do these bullets occur?
I'll show you some data in just a little while, but there's no fixed rule, as a matter of fact. I mean, things can be quiescent for years and then be episodic for months. Things can be quiescent for the whole time we've been ever looking at them. There are things that we see not to emit. Others are very active going into quiescence for only a few months at a time and bursting and that sort of thing. So every source is a little bit different. There's really no general rule. But I'll show you some data that shows just how, you know, what the difference can be between a quiescent state and a bursting state. Yes?
But later, is there an order of magnitude of material involved in bursting, say, one solar mass and the length of the solar mass?
We don't. I don't think we know anything about that. I mean, what we observe is a flux level of photons coming off, right? And to reverse engineer that to answer that question would involve understanding these things at a level that we don't yet understand, so we don't know.
Is the shortest time period you see days, or is it?
The shortest time period currently is actually hours, and that's limited, we believe, by the resolution of our instrument, which is one of the reasons you go to comprehensive instruments, and that's a point I'll make a little bit later, in order to find out what the true turn on time, because it could be minutes, could be seconds, we don't know.
So that's something about how big the thing is.
That's saying about something about the geometry of the emission zone, absolutely, yes. Or it can be interpreted that way, that's right. So, still speaking about AGNs, again, we don't know the emission mechanisms, as I've just pointed out, but some of these objects at least emit at up to relatively high energies, several tens of or hundreds of GeV, TeV rather. So this is a particular object, Markarian 421, which is an AGN. And again, this is data of energy or frequency related, of course, versus flux. And you can see it's got this characteristic double hump structure with admittedly more ratty data than the crab. Part of the reason that the data looks ratty is that this is actually an episodic source. It's a source that can be quiescent and be emitting at one level and then suddenly emit at 10 times that level some day or some month. And so depending on when you take the data, you can have different flux levels in here. But in general, when it's faint, it's like these two lower curves, and when it's flaring, it can be in the upper curves. And it's tempting, certainly, to say that there's a natural explanation here as the same thing that's happening in the crab, that is, this synchrotron population is the photons that have been upscattered to give you this population, but in fact, we don't really know that. As we make more observations, we start to constrain these models, and hopefully we will learn much more about these things. And then, and not to put too much emphasis on this, because this is all very speculative, but let me just mention at least that that's all sort of known physics, the physics of hadronic interactions and electronic interactions, and you may not know the details, but I would argue there's not much new physics in there, but you could also imagine that new physics could give you signatures that you would see in the age of gamma. So for instance, you could have particle physics at very high mass scales, like SUSY, and I'll talk specifically about dark matter. You could have GAT scale particles, you could have relics from the early universe. You would not build detectors, presumably, if this was the only thing that you would hope to shed light on, because it's all very speculative. But it could very well happen that you've got the detectors, you're looking at gammas, and these things have observable signatures and critical signatures that we can look at and investigate. So just to give you one transparency on dark matter and SUSY, because I'll come back to it when I talk about observations, of course one of the ideas is that the lightest supersymmetric particle provides a relatively nice solution to the dark matter problem. It's typically, although not always, taken to be a neutralino. They would, in principle, cluster in galactic centers or in galactic clusters and could then potentially annihilate, giving rise to these photons. And so you would generally expect to see some sort of a broad bump in gamma ray spectrum if you looked at the galactic center or center of galactic clusters. And I'll show you some data from the galactic center in a few minutes, as a matter of fact, which was initially taken to be possibly due to this, although I think the jury is still very, very clearly up on it. Okay, turning now to the detection mechanisms. Gamma ray astronomy was pioneered by instruments that were in space, and notably I talked about the EGRIT instrument, which is one of the four instruments on a NASA great observatory called the Compton Gamma Ray Observatory, which was flown in the last decade. Deorbited in about 2000, so it had four instruments, OSSI, COMTEL, EGRIT, and BATSI. EGRIT is the instrument here, which was about this big or so. Its active area was about the size of two sheets of paper, A4 or letter size, your choice. The energy range was sort of 30 MeV to 20 GeV or so, and it was spark chamber technology, which basically means that a photon comes in and it converts at some point, and it's detected in these spark chambers as an E plus and minus pair, and then it's absorbed here in the calorimeter, and you can extrapolate back to get the gamma ray arrival direction. You can do that typically to about a 1 degree accuracy or so. The universe turns out to have a lot of interesting objects in every single square degree, which is one of the reasons a lot of the egret point sources were unidentified in the end, because in a one degree box, there's lots of things that could potentially be gamma ray emitters in a lot of those, over a lot of the sky. It's interesting also to point out this upper energy limit, 20 GeV. In this, in the particular case of egret, this was partially sort of self-inflicted, in the sense that one of the things they had was this charged particle anechoic incidence shield. So one of the things you're trying to protect against or differentiate the gamma rays from is a charged particle hitting your detector. And so you've got a shield here. If the charged particle produces a signal on the shield, of course a neutral particle won't, then you veto the event. And it turns out that at very energetic gamma rays, the gamma ray would come in here and interact, and it would have enough power, enough energy, that there would actually be backscattered particles that would then trigger this anti-coincidence shield. So it became self-triggering at very high energies. Not a brilliant design, we now realize, but in fact, their goal was not to get to above 20 GeV, it was to open up the 100 MeV to a few GeV windows. So it was wildly successful there. But we now know in our next effort we won't do that. However, even if they had not had that problem, you run into problems of fluxes, and the fluxes, of course, are going at 1 over E squared, so anything that's space size limited, like this size, then fundamentally runs into a flux limit at about 10 or 20 GeV anyways. That is, you only expect a few events in the lifetime of the mission. And the highest energy photon in egret was about 23 GeV, I think. So satellite observations are the way to go and is what pioneered gamma ray astronomy. But it turns out to be difficult to push above 10 GeV. First of all, they're costly to go to space. A launch itself, just a single launch, I mean, if you launch, you know, an empty box into space, NASA will charge you between $500 and $700 million. That's kind of tough to justify. Long lead times, low fluxes. So, for instance, on the Crab, at energies above 10 GeV, you've got 100 gammas per square meter per year. There should be a square meter, a square there. So 100 gammas per square meter per year. So that means that you're observing only a few gammas at very, very high energies. So you'd like to go to the ground, but ground-based observations are hindered by the fact that the atmosphere is an absorber, of course, and we know that the atmosphere is relatively transparent in only two narrow energy or wavelength bands around the optical and around the radio. And it turns out that in the gammas, it's fairly opaque. So you can't just do this from the ground the way optical astronomers work from the ground. Instead, you have to be a little craftier, and you have to use the atmosphere as part of your detector. So what happens then is that you use the fact that these primaries coming to you from the galaxy or extragalactically then interact in the upper atmosphere. And in that interaction, they will produce a whole bunch of charged secondaries. And those charged secondaries turn out to be locally moving faster than the local speed of light. And that means they radiate Cherenkov radiation. Cherenkov radiation typically is in blue. It's got a 1 over lambda squared spectrum, but it's typically 350 nanometers to sort of 500 or so. So you get this cone of blue light, and of course the atmosphere is relatively transparent at those that's now in the optical, so that light will actually propagate to the ground. So you're actually detecting the light that's produced up here, this Cherenkov light, that propagates to the ground and you can detect in your telescope. Notice that the way cosmic ray physics is done at the very highest energies is to take advantage of the fact that at the very highest energies, these secondary showers are very large, and many of the secondaries actually make it to the ground as charged particles. And that's what, of course, Auger does, is to detect these secondaries on the ground over very large areas. So we detect the Cherenkov light, and it turns out that although this shower takes microseconds to develop over, say, a few kilometers up here, the photons, the shower is moving effectively at the same speed as the Cherenkov photons, and so the Cherenkov photons come down as a very narrow, flat pancake that is about this big or so. It's about 3 or 4 nanoseconds in width. So this light comes out as a flash. It doesn't come out over microseconds. It comes down to the ground as a flash, and it's detectable. So the Cherenkov signal then is relatively fast. It's directional, because it carries with it the Cherenkov angle and the direction of the original primary. And it's approximately linear. That is, if you have a primary particle that has twice the energy, you get twice as much Cherenkov light out. So that's exactly what an experimentalist likes in a calorimeter. Effectively, this is turning the atmosphere into a calorimeter. So you're looking at showers like this. This is a gamma ray shower. These are simulations, obviously. And this is a gamma ray shower coming from about 20 kilometers up to ground level here. And you can see that it's a relatively narrow shower. So you're, and actually, this is not ground level here. This is only over the first 4 or 5 kilometers of the atmosphere. And the background that we're fighting against is charged cosmic rays, of course, which are 10 to the 4 times more likely, more common, but they have, because this is a hadronic interaction as opposed to an electromagnetic interaction, they have a very much sparser look to them, and in fact, you can distinguish between these. Yes, Lee.
Yeah,
is
that a little photograph
on
the previous one?
Excuse me, I'm sorry.
I don't want to
break your. This one, you mean? No, this is an artist's conception. Yeah. No, you can't photograph this stuff. I mean, first of all, photons are all going that direction, right? If you try to take a photograph, a high-speed photograph, they're not coming to you, right? No, this is an artist. These are all artist's conceptions. I could have said yes. That would have been nice. Okay. So the first people to use this. Oh, interesting. How much can I pull over? Okay. So the first successful application of this stuff was by the technique was by a group rather that was called Whipple Group, and it's actually Smithsonian Astrophysical Observatory Group that runs a telescope in Mount Hopkins in Arizona. This is what it looks like. So this is a 12-meter or 10-meter telescope rather here. And at the so this sort of looks like astronomy the way we're all taught about astronomy in grade school, because it's a big dish. But what we're doing is, of course, focusing the light not onto a CCD camera, for instance, which is what an optical astronomer would do, but onto a much larger photo tube camera composed of things that are capable of detecting single photons. So schematically, of course, here's our shower, there's the Cherenkov light pool, and this is a few hundred meters in diameter here, so these things are relatively big. And you detect some amount of that light that comes into your telescope. And the interesting thing here is that the interaction point could be here, and the light pool could be there, but the light pool could also be over here from the interaction point here, and you have still detected some of that light. So in fact, the effective area of your telescope is much larger than your telescope. Right, because the effective area is as big as that light pool, and so it's tens of thousands of square meters. So you immediately combat the flux problem that I was talking about earlier, and you can detect these sources. The power of the Cherenkov technique is that in the focal plane of the telescope, you see images like this. These are again simulated, but this is a 1 TeV gamma ray. This would be a 1 TeV hadron. The hadronic shower, of course, is a lot radier, just like the plots I showed you a couple of transparencies ago. This one's much more uniform. And so in a real telescope, they would look like this. These are supposed to be circles, and somehow they've been skewed, but OK. So here's what a gamma candidate may look like. And here's a splotch image that looks a lot more like a hadronic interaction. And so by doing image analysis on these things, you can actually reject this background and enhance this signal. The way you do that is by fitting ellipses to these things, and in principle, the ellipse should point back to the aiming point of your telescope. And so you parameterize it as this mismatched angle between the line that joins the image to the center of the telescope versus the semi-major axis of the ellipse, fundamentally, and you should see an enhanced number of events at very small angles, and that's exactly what you see here. So this is that angle there, number of events, and you can see that there's some background out here and a clear excess at very small angles, and that's what's telling you that you're actually seeing photons. And so here, in this particular case, the signal to noise was really good, 10 to 1 or so. And you can actually make sky maps the way standard astronomers are used to looking at them. Somebody had a question about time, the temporal aspects of these things. So with these techniques, these Cherenkov techniques, the second generation of these Cherenkov telescopes was able to achieve sensitivities to the Crab on typically hour timescales. And it's important that we get that number down. We'd really, ideally, like to be able to turn on our detector and say within seconds whether a particular object that we're looking at is emitting, because the more information you have about the temporal onset of these flares, the more information you have about what's going on in the geometry of the AGNs, for instance. So here's an AGN, Markarian 421, that I talked about before. This is 4 years' worth of observations. So there's a series of observations here. And then 360 days later, there's another series here, and you can see that it was basically in a quiescent state here, a little bit more active there, and then suddenly it was flaring there. We have no information here because it's not in our field of view, because at that point it's a daytime source. So suddenly it's episodic, and then it comes back and it's quiescent again with sort of little burps and hiccups in here. If you zoom in on this, this is now about two or three months worth of data, every night that it's dark and that we can observe. You zoom in on some of this, here's a night in which the flux, for instance, grew by a factor of two. Here's a night in which the flux went from some quiescent level to very large levels in the space of just an hour or so. And that's ultimately, our resolution there is what is the dominating feature there. We don't know whether it was actually in seconds that it did that or in an hour. Okay, and so we'd really like to have more sensitive instruments so that we can, the next time this thing happens, we can actually map out that turn-on and thus get information about the geometry. The technological limit for these single imagers, I would claim, is being pushed by a project called MAGIC, which is a German-Spanish collaboration in the Azores, or some Canaries, I'm sorry. And they are half built actually, a 17-meter mirror that has 900 diamond-milled facets on it. It's a very, very light map so that they can slew across the sky very quickly to capture transients, gamma ray bursts, for instance. Active optics, which means that they correct for the wind and the mechanical sag of the instrument, and optical fiber transport of the signals so that the camera here remains relatively light. And so it's very difficult to see how we are going to go beyond for a single imager at least sort of 17 to 20 meter scale. Although I won't talk about this, but Hess is actually trying to push that now and finding it is quite difficult. This is a single imager, but it turns out that most people are actually trying to push the technique by going in a different direction. And that is the idea of building arrays of imaging telescopes. So not one, but several telescopes, more or less identical. And the idea here is that you separate the telescopes by less than the size of the giant but light pool on the ground, which is a few hundred meters. So you've got this few hundred meter light pool. Instead of having a single telescope now, add several telescopes in there. And so the idea is that you're trying to distinguish between a photon density on the ground that looks like this for a gamma ray versus a photon density on the ground that looks like this for a proton shower because of the sparseness of the shower process in the upper atmosphere. And you do that by having multiple views of the same shower up in the atmosphere because you've got multiple telescopes. So each of these telescopes, for instance, in this case, would give you, impact point was here, then each of these telescopes would give you a view on the ground that looks like this. In the field of view of the telescopes, when you put all three telescope images together, you have multiple images of the same shower. And that means that you've got enhanced ability to reconstruct both where that shower came from, but also the number of photons that landed in each of these in each of these images, which means an increased ability to measure the energy of the photons. So there is now a worldwide network of arrays that either are in operation or entering operation. Kangaroo is a Japanese-Australian collaboration in Australia. MAGIC is, just talking about MAGIC, of course, a 17-meter dish, but they're now actually building a second 17-meter dish, so they're going to do both things, sort of pushing the single telescope limit and having multiple telescopes. We're building Veritas, which will be four telescopes in Arizona, and HESS is a four-telescope array that is operational now in Namibia. It's a Franco-German collaboration. I'll talk a little bit more about that. And then sometime next year, we hope that BLAST will fly. BLAST is a new satellite instrument that follow on to EGRIT, and it will provide all-sky, all-time coverage. So it'll be a very, very important component to these things, but it's somewhat lower energies. And for the remainder of the talk, I'm going to talk about the HESS results. And the disclaimer here is that this isn't my experiment. This one is my experiment. But the bottom line is these people are doing really good science. And if you want to know about that, and eventually we will also come on stream and I'll tell you about that. So HESS is a Franco-German project. It's got these four telescopes in the Namibian desert west of Windhoek, which is the capital of Namibia here in Gamsberg. You can tell they're real because here's a postage stamp that they made, or that Namibia made for them, actually. So that's kind of nice. But this is a photo montage, but it really does look like that. There are actually four telescopes that work very, very well. HESS can see the galactic center because they're in the Southern Hemisphere. The Southern Hemisphere is privileged for the galactic center. It's high in their sky. And so it's, that was one of the places that Hess decided to spend a lot of time early on in our jury program. So you've maybe all seen a poster that NASA produced, which is called the Multi-Wavelength Milky Way, in which you have multiple images of the center of the galaxy, Milky Way, and you can see that at every wavelength you learn something different about the galaxy. So for instance, in the infrared, you're seeing into star formation regions, and so a lot of it is relatively bright. In the optical, you're obscured by dust and cloud, for instance, so you're learning something different. You're in particular not seeing a direct correlation with image with stellar formation regions, for instance. And we now have, thanks to Hess, and an image of the center of the galaxy in VHE gamma. So here's the Hess center, the Hess field of view, and so they tiled this center of the galaxy with multiple exposures of their field of view. It took several hundred hours to produce this very nice map of the galactic center. Here's what it looks like in more detail. So this is the galactic center here. We're looking at a narrow strip along the Milky Way, so the galactic center, like this. This point is the same as this point. There's 30 degrees on one side in galactic longitude and 30 degrees on the other side in galactic longitude. And in this one multiple exposure, admittedly several hundred hours, Hess discovered a whole plethora of sources. Some of them are named here, sources that are greater than six sigma statistically, so that means that they're unequivocally new sources. There are a total of 11, of which nine have never been seen before in gamma rays. And I will focus in on just a couple of them. One is the galactic center here, and one is this thing, which is a supernova remnant. Notice the size of it, and notice the difference in size of these things. You can tell then that some of these are extended sources and some of them are point sources. Notice that Hess has clearly creamed off the top of, in terms of counting their sources, but it's clear also to anybody who looks at this that there's a whole bunch of places that are clear gamma emitters that Hess will now probably focus in on and do more detailed work. This point here, these points here, this point here, that point there, there's a whole bunch of them. So you, I would claim that in this one exposure, just by eye, Hess probably has 20 new sources or so. And that's what a well-designed, well-run, well-built instrument, of course, can do to you. Hopefully teach you a lot. So here's the supernova remnant I talked about in the previous page. It's called RXJ1713 because it's an X-ray source. It's known to be an X-ray source. This is the first definitive detection of supernova remnant in gamma rays in which you can see that it's spatially resolved. That is, you can start to see the morphology of the region. It's an extended source, clearly. It turns out also to be spectrally resolved. That is, the photon energies have been measured. And there's an extremely good correlation, importantly, there's an extremely good correlation between the colors here, which are the gamma ray emission levels, and the X-ray images from different instruments, which are the contours here. And that's telling you then that the physical processes that give rise to the X-rays are probably the same ones, or certainly correlated with the physical processes that give rise to the gammas. And so that hopefully will help us to disentangle this idea of, are we actually accelerating cosmic rays here, for instance? We don't know yet, it's probably too early to say. But certainly, this is the sort of quality of data we are becoming accustomed to. This is the point spread function, the resolution function of the Hess telescope. So you can see that this is very clearly not consistent with point spread function. I mean, it's very clearly an extended source. Turning to the galactic center, the galactic center is known to be a radio emitter. This is a radio image of the center of the galaxy. It's got several supernova remnants here and supernova remnants here. It's got a bright central source, which is called Sagittarius A. There's the Hess image of the same region. This source is that source, and this source is that source. So there are now two known gamma ray sources close to the center of the galaxy. It turns out that there's a very good correlation then with the X-ray. Notice how well correlated this supernova remnant is with the X-ray emission, with the radio emissions. And the gamma ray emissions here at the galactic center are also extremely well correlated with the radio emissions from the center. This is the supernova, which is sort of modestly interesting, but we've got other supernovas, and this is the other one's the galactic center, called Sagittarius A. So one of the things that people got excited about in Sagittarius A was the fact that this has never previously been observed in gamma rays. So in the GED regime, the galactic center has been looked at before with less sensitive instruments, and nobody has ever seen it to emit in gamma rays. But this is clearly a very unequivocal detection. It's a four sigma statistically, four sigma detection. It's nearly, but not quite, a point source. Notice that this thing is not quite round. It's somewhat out of round. The point spread function is a circle, of course, and it's slightly larger than the point spread function, which means that there's evidence that it's an extended source. It's got a hard, flat spectrum as well. Now, the galactic center is an interesting place. for a number of reasons. So, and so here's one of the reasons the Galactic Center is interested. This is optical data now, and these are very high-quality images made by a group at UCLA, by Andrea Goetz. And you can see the data up here. So everything prior to 2003 is real data. And then from 2003 on, this is the result of a simulation. What you're seeing is a bunch of stars. Each one of these blue points is a star, an observed star, that has been observed several times so that the trajectories of these stars are known. And they're drawn out here. And notice that they, it turns out that they're all on Keplerian orbits, which means that you can actually, from a Keplerian orbit, of course, extract a mass for the central object. And it turns out that the mass is about 4×10⁶ solar masses. And there's very good evidence that it's a black hole. Interestingly enough, some of these are really, really interesting. This one is a star that has a complete revolution of about 15 years. So it's coming back just about now to complete, to where we first found it in our first star. First time in its first observations. And so as it comes in for a second pass, of course, people will be looking and trying to measure the orbital parameters in detail. This one is even more interesting because at its closest distance of approach way down here, back of the movie, a few frames into the movie, it comes to within about 75 or 80 astronomical units of the dynamical center of the galaxy where presumably the black hole is housed. So it's sampling space very, very, very close in to this massive black hole. But notice that there's no tremendous amount of material that would provide, in particular, provides luminosity here, light, or that would be an obvious candidate for something that would be emitting gamma rays. Right? Turns out, of course, this is at a different scale too. This is a tenth of an arc second. The Hess image is about this big here. Okay, but nonetheless, we are starting to know a lot about the galactic center, and it's not, there's no appreciable concentration of luminous material down to something like hundreds of, I think this is incorrect, I think I made a mistake in calculating this, hundreds of Schwarzschild radiuses or something. And so this is one of the reasons that people got very excited about the Hess result.
What's so, very narrow, is that really such a centric ellipse, or is that one that's just seen by John?
This one here? It's really an eccentric ellipse. I mean, it really comes in and goes back out.
So it's not that we're just seeing it kind of obliquely.
It doesn't matter, does it? I mean, at some point down here, it doesn't matter whether you're seeing it obliquely or what. It's very close to.
It's not close to the word. That's a focus, I say. You're saying that that's a focus of the
right. But you're right. You can distinguish now. Okay, and you've asked this question before, so now I know the answer. The first time I did. It turns out then, and I don't know the answer for this particular thing, but it turns out that an ellipse, you know, that has two foci, if you look at it from the side, then it's also an ellipse, but the foci, of course, are not in the right place for a Keplerian orbit. So you can actually make good enough measurements to distinguish between those two cases, mm-hmm. right? Between looking at something edge on or looking at it like this and have a very narrow ellipse. And I don't know the answer in this particular case. So the galactic center then for Hess is here's the data, and this is in degrees squared from the center, and you can see that it's about 1, so it's about a tenth of a degree or so, and notice that there's this long tail, so it's not quite consistent with the point source. If it just had this Gaussian part here, then it would be consistent with the point source. It's not quite consistent with the point source, slightly extended, but it is consistent with the dynamical center of the galaxy, and so clearly there's something that's a gamma ray emitter at the center of the galaxy that we don't know really what that's telling us, and people were initially excited by the fact that this could potentially be an observation of dark matter, although I think that the jury is out.
Is it really?
Okay.
Did that really say it was within 6 seconds of arc?
Six seconds of arc. Tenth of a degree would be 6 minutes. Yes, I believe that's probably true because, of course, the resolution, you get much better resolution on the central point than you do on the width. I believe that's correct statement. Okay, so here's what the TEV gamma ray sky looked like. I'm close to finishing. Here's what the TEV gamma ray sky looked like in about 2003 or so before the Hess came on stream. There were something like, 13 or 14 sources here. I've talked to you about several of them, Crab, there's pulsars. But some of the notable ones, of course, is our standard candle Crab out here. There was an unknown source that I haven't talked about here that was discovered in the Northern Hemisphere. And then there was some indication, but very rapid data, about emission from the galactic center. Here's what the source counts look like in terms of broken down by
by type of source in 2003. There was something like a dozen of acres, dozen of sources or so. Once Hess turned on by late 2005, and of course this number is changing virtually every week as Hess does more observations and discovers more sources, there's been a real explosion because of a well-designed, well-built sensitive instrument coming on stream, and they've discovered a number of new classes of sources as well as several new sources of known source classes. So also Ringnebula, the Crab, for instance, or AGNs, and a bunch of unidentified sources as well. So Hess has really done very well, and of course when we have Veritas on stream, we believe that we also will help to do that, and the more data we have about these types of sources, the more we're hopefully going to understand. So let me finish with just a few transparencies on Veritas and GLASS since I mentioned them. Veritas is the North American analog of Hess. It's 4 × 12 meter telescopes. It's an expansion of this collaboration that pioneered the way with Whipple, and it's got Canadian participation, but it's primarily a U.S. collaboration, and it's building telescopes that are going to go in Arizona on Mount Hopkins. It's got a camera like this that has about 500 PMT, so slightly smaller than the Hess cameras, 3.5 degree field of view, slightly lower energy threshold, very good angular resolution. And here we expect to have a crab detection, coming back to your question, in 20 seconds. If you had something that was emitting at the crab level, we'd know that and be able to tell you within 20 seconds or so. Compare that to the 1 hour for the Whipple and several hours, for instance, for Stacey. This is maybe a detail that I don't need to talk about. The first two telescopes are actually operational now at Mount Hopkins. This is not a fully monitored house, this is real. And we are routinely starting observations of them taking data together and triggering together. And we're assembling the next two telescopes, so by the end of 2006, October 2006 or so, we hope to have both of those and the four telescopes that they're just on stream. GLASS is the next satellite-launched telescope. GLASS will be a still constrict tracker up here, and then cesium iodide calorimeter back there. Notice that there's no gas, so there's no consumable, so in principle it's got a relatively long lifetime in orbit, and it will have an anti-coincidence beetle that is more sophisticated than EGRITs in order to avoid this detection, this problem of self-triggering. Here's what it looks like as it comes together at SLAC. Stanford, so it's got the first 12 of 16 towers in this photograph, and it is on track to be launched sometime in mid-2007 to late 2007. Here's what a simulation of the sources in the sky looks like. So if you take the source types that we know of from EGRIT, for instance, and you assume reasonable spectra, and you build in the sensitivity of GLASS and the thresholds of GLASS, then in one year, all sky survey, you would expect the GLASS sky map to look something like this. Several thousands of new sources, because of course it's observing most of the sky at once, and it's got a duty cycle that is very, very high because it doesn't have to worry about darkness and moonlight. So clearly it will be a very, very useful tool to allow the pointing instruments on the ground, Veritas and Hess, to actually point to new or to flaring sources, and thus to help to open up this TDB and TDB sky. So then in conclusion, I think that the future of ground-based gamma-ray astrophysics is bright. Certainly, we are probing astrophysics in regimes that we don't completely understand or are not yet completely explored. Most of the sky, as a matter of fact, is totally unknown at the TEB energy scale because the ground-based instruments are pointing instruments, so we can only look at very specific things, and we don't waste our time going and looking on a wild goose chase. We'd like to know that there's a source there before we spend time observing it. There's a series of new instruments. Veritas, of course, is operational. Veritas and GLASS will be operational over the course of the next year or so. These are complementary. Hess and Veritas are in different time zones and different hemispheres, and that's important for continued coverage of the source. GLASS will be an all-sky, all-year monitor. And so I think there's significant potential for discovery of new physics. So thank you very much.
In the determination of the mass of that object, the interior is based off.
Sorry?
So in order to determine the mass, you need to know the Keplerian orbit of the stars.
I believe that's correct.
You have to assume something about the structure of the orbit.
Well, the thing is, it's one of these things where you certainly can't, on a first piece of data, determine the mass. But after three or four exposures, so if you look when this restarts, I think the first data comes from 1997, and after three or four periods, then you've got enough to put into to understand the orbital dynamic, the orbital parameters of all of these things at a relatively good level, and it just gets better the more data you take.
So the star is coming in close.
Yeah, right. This one here.
Yeah, this one comes in close.
Yeah, that's that.
Is that a hydrophobic or a bit of a parent?
You've got me. I don't know the details.
This is a very important determining the mass.
There's notice the first data is 1995.
I don't see how we can determine the shape of that orbit.
I can point you to the paper, but I don't know the details of that. And the claim is that it's 4 × 10⁶, and I think the quoted error was about 10% on that.
But there must be an assumption, isn't it?
There are
only
10 stars. So
yeah, no, I think with 7 or 8 stars, you can probably resolve discrepancies like that.
I'd like to argue sort of that. See what it means.
Sorry?
Well, certainly, no, pretty soon it's going to turn around again, right?
Right, for this one. For this one, yeah. So the quoted errors in the paper were, I think, less than 10% on the central mass.
I decided to repeat, it depends on the assumptions you make about the ephemeris of the structure.
That may be true if you've got a single orbit. If you have multiple orbits, I think you may be able to break that degeneracy, but I admit that I'm not an expert.
Yes, can you say a bit more between the differences between Veritas and HAT? So you said that they're, well, different things here, that's important, but in terms of technology, in terms of sensitivity and things like that, can you do the HAT that you have to do? Or?
Well, first of all, we have access to half the sky that they don't see, and vice versa, they have half, right? So in terms of looking at individual objects, we've got the northern hemisphere that, so from a point of view, I guess the way to pitch that is that from the point of view of AGNs, you know, we each have our own populations of AGNs. There's a small number of things that we will be able to look at together. They have the galactic center, admittedly. The galactic center will be low on our horizon because we're a northern observatory. In theory, in principle, you could actually observe the galactic center from Veritas, but it would be so low on the horizon that your threshold would be very high and it would not be worthwhile using the instrument. However, we have certain regions, like the Cygnus region, the Cygnus arm of our galaxy, which turn out to be nearby, relatively important star production areas, where we believe that there may also be very important sources to be found, for instance. Okay. Then the point that I made in terms of complementarity, geographical complementarity, I don't have a map actually, so the transparency is back, was the fact that sometimes what you really want to do, because these sources are episodic, is keep them under observation for as long as possible. And so the very fact that you're in different time zones, that you're approximately 120 degrees apart, means that you have more coverage than if you were both, say, in the same time zone for a particular source that happens to be at the right latitude. So with any luck, we will have sources like that where we can double our temporal coverage by virtue of having these two instruments.
So my question was really about disregarding the
Disregarding the geography, right? Intrinsically. Yeah. Intrinsically, they're very similar. There are a couple of major differences. Here's one of them. We are a slightly smaller field of view. We've got a 5-degree field of view, which means that for things like the galactic survey, they can tile that plane more quickly than we could, for instance. Okay, so that's a disadvantage for us. On the other hand, one of the advantages that we have is here that I skipped over, and that is that all of our photo tubes, this is what one of our cameras looks like. And so each one of these things is a single photo tube, which is physically about yay big, and the camera as a whole is about yay big. And these PMTs, what they do is read out the PMTs integrating over time, over a narrow time window. What we do is digitize that information at 500 megahertz, so that's 2 nanosecond pulses, and we get time structure through our images. And it turns out that this is new. Nobody's ever run a detector like this, and we're just learning how to use it. But we believe that this will give us tremendous background rejection, because you can actually see the time developed at the shower. And in fact, we've seen in our early data, for instance, this is a gamma ray, you're pointing out here somewhere. So what you're doing is looking at this is the top of the shower up in the atmosphere, and this is the lower part of the shower, and we can actually see the photons come in at different times as the shower progresses. And we believe that, for instance, will allow us to do substantially better image reconstruction and background rejection. But those are the two major differences, sort of field of view and the flash ADCs. The other differences are all relative. Okay, they're baseline differences. They are, they're on perfect square. We're on sort of a jury rig quadrilateral, which is not very regular, but we don't think that those are big differences in fact.
Can you both see?
The really important difference is that they're 2 years ahead.
Can you see that? You said 20 seconds was your rise.
Something like that, yeah.
Is that also progressive?
It's very equivalent because we'll have equivalent sensitivities. That's right. I don't know their exact number, but it can't be much more than that group of magnitude. Yes?
So what are the typical redshifts or distances of objects which are coming outside?
Sorry, the typical redshifts?
Yeah, this is typical distance because the flux.
That depends on, obviously, on the intrinsic luminosity of the things, but more importantly, it turns out that also depends on the absorption that occurs between the two. And so the photons are absorbed off the infrared background, and it turns out that the most of the AGNs that we've seen up till now have been relatively close by. For instance, the two Markarians that are known emitters are both at 0.03 in terms of redshift, so they're really close by. The furthest known emitters that have been detected are 0.13 or 0.14 redshift. It will be tough for us to go beyond about 0.4 or 0.5 just because of this absorption. So we're really not looking, you know, way out into the galaxy. We're not looking at high redshift.
What about glass?
Yeah, glass has a further, that's right, glass does see further because they're largely lower energies, but I don't know the number just off the top of my head for glass. But as a matter of fact, that's one of the assumptions that goes into this plot here, is what the redshift distribution of these objects looks like. And I remember that there was quite a bit of discussion as to whether they had chosen a reasonable model, but of course we won't know that until, you know, they actually make the observations.
Yeah, I was going to say that this is that missing from here are the gamma ray bursts, presumably.
That's correct.
Which are cosmological distances.
That's correct. So, again, now we do have some information on redshifts, although it's very spotty in GRPs. So there is. And so it'll be interesting to see how energetic they are. I mean, it could be that they're always missing from here because the distribution of photon energies just doesn't go up to MGUVs. We certainly, on the ground, one of the things that we've always said is that we are going to try to be very sensitive to GRBs, and we generally all have procedures so that on a GRB alert, we can be on the GRB if it's in our field of view within typically a minute or so. We all know it's a long shot that to think that a GRB might emit at say several hundred GeV. But it would be interesting to know.
So it would be very interesting for the timing measurements to test relativity, if you could.
If you could do that, yeah. No, it would be, I mean, okay, we'll phone you after, but yeah. It would be very interesting just to see if they emit those energies, right? Because nobody knows what their spectrum really looks like above, you know, a few hundreds of energy.
Well, that would be a lazy question. I mean, okay. If you were to look at different frequencies, joining frequencies,
different energies,
different energies. What kind of time resolution do you have to separate between like the original time resolution?
This is something we looked at in some detail. So you're talking about trying to take a burst and say what the arrival time is of photons as a function of their energy, right? The arrival time of the photons is known to microseconds. Okay, I mean, we basically have GPS timing on every single one of our events, so we know it to microseconds. Sort of straight out of the box, without even working at it. And so there have been studies to look at just what sort of, in particular, the way I've seen it cast is that you can use those to put an upper limit on function. The speed of light is a function of energy. Okay. And I don't know the energy. I don't know the exact numbers, but these are currently the best limits we have on C being constant. And they're basically, they use the fact that you've got a cosmological baseline. I mean, you're using megaparsec distances with microsecond time.
It's a cumulative effect,
obviously. Right, exactly, yeah. So I can point you to three references for that, for instance. This is something we have to.
I'm going to ask one last question. You mentioned on Monday about the gamma rays in the Galactic Center that there was some attempt to interpret that in terms of dark matter. And
yeah.
That may not be successful depending on that.
Well, okay. The, so there was some initial speculation. I don't know if I can find the body easily. Maybe that's not. So there was some speculation that this could be, these gamma rays from galactics could be dark matter. And initially, the thinking was that one of the things that you would like to understand if it was dark matter, first of all, it would be hard to prove that on the basis of one source. But nonetheless, there are various models that have different cuspinesses for the way the dark matter accumulates at the core of a massive something like a galaxy. And so initially, I think people said, "Oh, this could be dark matter." And then the next, the first order response was, "Yeah, but the shape is not right." And I believe that it's been sort of left there in the press. We had a long discussion at lunchtime about what we really need to try to understand this. And actually, you can probably better summarize that discussion than I could. But I think from an experimentalist point of view, what we need is better measurements here. And obviously, what we need also is measurements of equivalent phenomena in, for instance, galactic clusters. If I could come to you with a plot that, for instance, shows that you see the same effect in a number of galactic clusters of different masses, and there's a correlation between the mass of the galactic cluster and the size of the effect, then that would be fairly strong evidence that you're looking at something that is clustering, which presumably then couldn't be dark matter, although that wouldn't be unequivocal. Is that what you wanted me to say?
Yeah, I think so. But one of the things, the stuff I got from the discussion was that if that was really the shape of dark matter, it would have agreement with dark matter and the model would have said it.
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah.
So that's what all tech holds, right?
Sorry?
I mean, this calculation for the dark matter density profile is what it's all.
That's right, and that's what we sort of discussed in modules. So they're done in the absence of a black hole, and presumably in the presence of a black hole.
Right.
That's right. And I'm not an expert.
I mean, would the Deakin hypothesis be its accretion disk, like for a solar mass black hole or a lighter black hole?
I think that's one of the possibilities, but it's kind of interesting that you wouldn't see it then. And I mean, there is known X-ray emission from the galactic center, but it's relatively weak, and it's kind of interesting that you don't see it very strongly optically, for instance. So there's a little bit of a, I use the word mystery, it's maybe not a mystery, but it's not completely clear what's producing this.
Any questions?
Oh, sorry.
One last question.
Oh, yeah, sure, in front.
Okay, well, then thank you.